Hej och varmt välkomna till Placera-podden. Idag ska jag, Collans, och min kära kollega Per Ståhl, som för dagen sitter i Istanbul faktiskt, göra en intervju med Ned Naylor som förvaltar Jupiters guld- och silverfond. Very glad to have you here, Ned.
Well, thank you very much. It's nice to be here.
We spoke to you about 2 years ago, I think. And then you said something about hyperinflation. What do you see when it comes to inflation at the moment?
Well, I mean, that's a big topic. It's obviously a big topic for everybody at the moment. I think that one of the problems of discussing inflation is the source of it and recognizing what the source is and to what extent monetary issuance impacts statistics versus it's impacting people's real world outcomes. Certainly, I see a lot of behavior in terms of asset prices, which infers a very different outcome in terms of what's really going on in that reaction function between monetary issuance and prices, either in the real world or in assets. But what I will say is that we appear to be at an important inflection point here, where obviously the market's expectation is that inflation is more or less trending lower now versus what could happen thanks to various different geopolitical and in fact monetary inputs that sort of loom ahead of us.
But when you look at the gold and silver markets at the moment, what do you see then?
The gold and silver market, of course, is made up of two separate things. Firstly, you've got the physical market, which everybody understands, and then you have the paper market, which is much, much bigger and is much more a technical exercise. So let's break it in two. The physical market is very, very strong into China, principally in gold, and into India, principally in silver. So what we have is very, very obvious growth in physical gold demand in China, mainly as a function of young people wanting to hedge what they see as investment risks taken on by their parents, principally in the form of the property market. There's a lot of delivery of physical gold through the Shanghai Gold Exchange. I think it's 1,400 tons in the last 12 months. It's a very, very big number. And meanwhile, 400 or 500 tons has left Western gold, physical gold ETF products. So while the US dollar gold price has been going up, the amount of gold held in Western exchange traded products has gone down quite substantially. And that spread is effectively being delivered into the Chinese physical market. Now, that is very interesting and it's very important because one wonders when ETF and ETP investors in the West want to reallocate to physical gold in portfolios, where is the gold going to come from to grow the unit size effectively of those exchange traded products? So there is an interesting component that lies ahead of us to do with that physical market. But in terms of the wider paper gold market, there is very, very little interest. You're seeing futures buying by trend following, but you're not seeing much in terms of long-only investors, wealth management, etc., buying the story. They're not doing that yet. I think that will happen. But for now, they're sticking with the investment choices they've made over the last 2-3 years, rather than rotating in. Silver, on the other hand, is an India-driven phenomenon to do with tech offshoring, a change in jewelry buying, solar panels. Something like 20% of all the silver that's mined globally each year has gone in simply into India in the first quarter of this year. Now, that's completely unsustainable, and that may well impact the price of silver over the next 12 to 24 months.
So where do you see the biggest opportunities for the next year? Is it in gold or silver?
Yeah, I mean, personally, I see the opportunities mainly in the very, very depressed development mining space. So the gold and silver mining stocks are very cheap anyway on a free cash flow and net asset value basis. So on traditional valuation metrics, they look very cheap anyway. Mm-hmm. But the development asset side, particularly in silver, where there is a clear supply-demand problem. In other words, we need more silver to be mined to match growing demand. That requires new silver projects to come online, but they're not being developed. And, you know, I see that particular subset of opportunity to be particularly obvious, but because they're that much cheaper still than the producing gold and silver mining companies, and these projects are really badly needed in order to deliver the silver that will be going into electronics, solar, batteries, etc., and into investment, of course, as well, over the next 10 years.
How do you play it in the fund? How are you positioning now? Where, have you done any sort of large repositioning for the last 3 to 4 months?
Yeah, so we have been adding some beta to the portfolio. We've been adding principally silver over gold due to the fact that the US dollar gold price has broken out in a very secular way, in a very long-term way. We see what's happened as being extremely meaningful. The relationship has changed between dollars and gold for the first time, arguably for the first time in 50 years, actually. Now, what that does is trigger, I suppose, the start of a long race. We're in the stealth phase, in my opinion, at the moment. We're in that moment where the market has completely changed, but people aren't necessarily moving on it. So we have decided to get ahead of that and add a bit more beta to the portfolio. Principally, we do that through silver. But you know, what we need to see now is the next phase of what has already happened, which is the arrival of long-only investors into the sector. And that will either be driven by another wave of higher dollar gold prices and dollar silver prices, or it could be a rotation. So, i.e. people who are seeing problems elsewhere in their equity space or within their alternatives or wherever it might be, seeking out an asset class which is doing well and is uncorrelated. It's hard to say which will come first, but I think both are potentially in play.
You mentioned uncorrelated. I mean, how do you think an investor should see gold and silver for diversification?
Well, it's an important question. And the answer is that they're monetary instruments. You know, one of the problems is the way that this topic is discussed. So people talk about precious metals, which is an entirely unhelpful phrase. Silver is not precious in terms of its price. It's very, very cheap. But gold and silver are monetary metals. They trade in foreign exchange markets. They are money. And that's not my opinion. They absolutely trade as FX pairs, foreign exchange pairs. So the answer is think about them in that way, which is to own gold and silver is effectively to not own local currency. So whether that's krona or euros or sterling or dollars, what you're doing when you own gold and silver is you're taking the view against holding your local currency, not in cash terms, but long, you know, holding it out. Then you want to look at it at a portfolio level and say, well, when does it decorrelate? And the answer is, of course, to do what I just said, which is when your local currency forward is looking worse, then this asset class will do better and better. And when, for example, the central bank, your local central bank, starts to talk about raising rates, generally the local currency will do quite well during that period. So this asset class won't do well. There's no obvious correlation, by the way, or causation, certainly, between equities or even fixed interest and the performance of gold, silver, or gold and silver mining companies. They are purely a reflection of local currency investment flows. And when it comes to the mining companies, they are very obviously very dependent on the US dollar, because that drives interest levels into and out of the mining equity.
What risks do you see going forward in the silver and gold markets?
Principally, the risks in the silver and gold markets are what we just discussed, which is should the Fed, which is, of course, the world's central bank now, signal that it's going to be substantially more hawkish than is priced in, then you should expect the US dollar gold price to trade lower. Having said that, I think that it's obvious that there would be very severe consequences for other asset classes if they did that. So the margin of error or the likelihood of something like that seems lower than it might have been in the past. But yes, it's always to do with hawkish or dovish. The most simple way to think about this is, you know, the downside risk is to do with being hawkish and the upside is to do with being dovish.
Could you just go through a little bit of your investment process?
Sure. So when we think about physical metals, we think about counterparty risk. You know, we're talking about the risk-free form of money here, a gold bar or a gold coin. So it's that on one level is a very simple observation, which is why a lot of people like it, by the way. It's because it's a very simple observation. And if you own it yourself in your home, then you have removed all counterparty risk and you are owning risk-free cash that you yourself are taking responsibility for. Now, of course, I can't do that, so I have to step away from that. But what I want to do is think about it purely in terms of unpriced counterparty risk. And there's layers of that. So when we think about the physical that we own, it's very much about trying to reduce those risks. I don't want the physical to be held in the banking system. I want the architecture of the unit that I'm holding to be legally as robust as possible. So principally what I mean by that is I'd prefer a security that is covered by the Securities Act versus an exchange-traded product, which has much looser legal structure. So leaving that aside and going into the mining equities, our investment process, again, is kind of similar, which is to always think about risk. Mining companies are very risky, of course. They also have lots of potential upside. So we think about it like a form of managed option. So we're always worrying about what those unpriced operating risks are in mining equities. One of the things that is not necessarily apparent to people investing on their own behalf in gold and silver mining companies are the technical aspects of these projects. So, for example, if you're investing in a development asset, so something that's not in production, if you look at the top line results that a company like that might have, they might look quite interesting. You might see something that looks, oh, it's quite big. It's got good grade. It's in a jurisdiction that seems reasonable. All of these things will be being ticked off. But there are many, many layers beyond that you need to go into in terms of due diligence to feel comfortable owning one of these companies. For a good example of one of those is recovery. So how easy is it, in fact, how possible is it to recover the metals from the ore that you are processing? And it's never as simple as you might think it would be. So you might well have an interesting asset in a good jurisdiction with scale and grade and even regional and state level support. But if you can't recover the metals in a metallurgical sense from that deposit in an economic way, the entire investment case is blown up. So the answer is there's a lot of bottom-up due diligence that goes into making an investment decision in a mining company. But I would also say that we own nearly 40 and we like to own at least 35, up to 50 of these companies because they do carry lots of complicated operating risks. And that way you're smoothing your overall outcome rather than being overexposed to any individual mining company and its specific risks.
Go back to diversification again, because I think the gold and silver is very nice as a diversification factor in the portfolio. What do you think, and the clients you have, how much do you think you should have in gold and silver in a portfolio?
Well, obviously, it totally depends on the individual. Yeah. And or the corporate or the pension or whoever it is who's doing it, because ultimately people do things for different reasons. It also depends on how you go about it. So if you invest in physical alone, there are studies, academic studies that suggest anywhere from 2 to 25% of physical gold in portfolios at all times. In fact, it seems to me the maths work better at 25%. Which doesn't surprise me because that's first of all a kind of classic central bank amount. It's what you would see a central bank having. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is it's a cash proxy. So it's effectively like having good cash in your portfolio. And if you imagine a cash instrument, you having a low amount doesn't really make that much difference at portfolio level. So the answer is there is no specific number. There are academic studies which can answer this in many, many different ways. Mm-hmm. But by owning gold and silver mining companies, what you can do is reduce the amount you need to have in order to create the same outcome as you would have if you just owned physical gold.
Mm-hmm.
But another way of putting it is, do you want a defensive diversification? And what I mean is, i.e., so just a small amount of diversification. Or do you want to take a view whereby you're really trying to diversify and you're taking a view that you think it will be a positive diversification? See, the problem is people don't really think about diversification in a clean way. No, they don't actually think about it as in it can go up or down. They think about it as it's going to diversify me up. Of course, is not how this really works. So some people think about it as, yes, it's going to diversify, but yes, I think it's going higher and I want to have a more tactical view of my diversification. So the answer is there is no simple answer to your question. It totally depends on the perspective of the person trying to diversify, but it is clear the asset class does diversify, you know, short, medium and long term in whatever quantity you choose to apply.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Bitcoin is not gold and silver, of course. But do you talk to investors that considering Bitcoin as well as a diversifier with gold and silver, or is Bitcoin just something else?
So I think when it first started, there was quite a good degree of crossover. Actually, when Bitcoin was first conceived of, it was intending to replicate gold and gold mining. So digital gold and the process of mining gold. However, now it's become financialized. It's full of leverage. People don't own it for diversification purposes. They own it as a directional bet.
Uh-huh.
It correlates very, very strongly with tech. And as we know, tech is, let's say, not cheap. So, you know, I just don't see the read across really anymore. There is one still very important philosophical alignment, which is both things, so gold and silver and Bitcoin, are about the individual's need, or rather lack of need, for banks and government when it comes to payment. So people like gold and silver, the same reason they like Bitcoin. They don't want banks. They don't want government involved in money.
Mm-hmm.
So there is still that clear alignment. But in terms of who is invested and how it behaves, I don't see any relationship anymore.
Okay. You were mentioning that China had been a quite big buyer. I assume, is it the people, or is the, you talk about people as well, but I think the central bank as well is buying quite a lot of gold, and that's one of the stories in the market, that their demand is, yeah, you know, one of the factors behind the gold price for the last 2 years since the war in Ukraine.
I don't agree with that at all. The buying of central banks has been very, very consistent ever since QE started. You know, you just see a consistent growth in central bank gold demand ever since 08. And of course, because when you start printing money, then central bankers understand what that means, and they want to hold less treasuries and they want to own more gold. There is no chance that Chinese central bank buying is moving the US dollar gold price. It just simply doesn't work that way.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Because the reason being is that two reasons. Firstly, I mentioned earlier, you've got physical gold and paper gold. So central banks buy physical gold. But physical gold is probably 3% of daily turnover in gold. It's a tiny amount. It just does not where the price is found. The price is found in all the derivatives of gold. So that's pure foreign exchange with no gold at all. That's futures, options, paper gold accounts that Asian banks offer their clients. None of this involves any gold at all. So what moves the US dollar gold price is nothing to do with the physical market. You can argue it a little bit more in terms of silver because the silver market is very tight. But no, I think that the Chinese gold demand story is to do with two things and not to do with central banks. First, it's to do with the retail. And they are definitely becoming more nervous and buying more gold. They're buying gold beans. I call them gold lentils because they look more like a lentil in terms of size. Mm-hmm. And they're holding these in little glass bottles and generally saving one gold bean a month from salaries. And then and holding this as a store of value as sound money. And then the other thing is the, I think we're returning to the old Bretton Woods system, and it looks like probably a decent part of the 1,400 tons delivered through the Shanghai Gold Exchange is probably going to settle Russian energy sales to China. Now, we don't know that, but it's something which has been discussed for a very long time, which is that the gold will return to its original Bretton Woods role, which is to settle trade imbalance. And I believe that a good proportion of that gold is going into Russia via the Shanghai Gold Exchange. I can't prove it, but it's certainly more meaningful than the narrative of the Chinese central bank buying gold. Okay. Bear in mind that all the Chinese gold that's mined every year, and China is the biggest gold mining country in the world, all of it is contained within the country. Now, obviously, some of the state-owned gold mining companies can deliver physical to the Chinese central bank, and you're not going to see that at all. So it's certainly not impacting price or anything like that. It's simply, that's like almost like a royalty stream from the mining companies into the state. So I think it's to do with the, it's to do with retail, it's to do with, potentially to do with settling international trade, which is also may explain why US real interest rates have been going up. And yet gold has also been going up in dollars. And a lot of people have been spotting that and going, why is that happening? And the answer is there is a genuine change has taken place in the way international trade is being settled and in the way the global market thinks about treasuries. Seeing as, of course, the US dollar gold price is the opposite or the inverse of treasuries or long-end treasuries.
But why do you see that now? I mean, is that because of the war and the new situation, the geopolitical situation?
Yeah, but that's not something new. Again, it's something that's been happening for nearly 10 years now.
Yeah.
But yes, at the margin, the move of the US to freeze Russian treasury holdings and now give some of them to the Ukraine for reconstruction, let's just say it doesn't make US treasuries that attractive as a reserve asset. I could be stronger in what I'm saying here, but you get the message.
Thank you.
Your fund has gained about 20% this year so far. When I look at the different kind of companies that you invest in, I only find Western companies. Why is that?
So the first thing to say is when you're looking at mining companies, you can't look at 800. So it's not one of those things where you can go, oh, I'm looking at all of them. It's way too much work to do that. So you need to find a way of filtering out some of your universe. It's simply not possible to do the amount of due diligence you need to do to be able to make good decisions. So one of the things we do is a geographic filter. It's not probably for the reason that one might imagine. So it's not actually to do with the risk of a country nationalizing a mine. Now, of course, that can happen, but it's to do with the operating risks. So we like investing in the Americas and Australia in mining. Because the operating risk variables are easier for us to manage. The labor generally is well trained. So if you think of Latin America or Australia, for example, or Canada, a lot of multi-generational mining families and people, you have clear regulations, you have good logistics. All of the variables we need to have covered up when we're modeling and understanding companies are easier in these jurisdictions. That's the main reason why we do that.
Mm. So you reduce your risk, so to speak.
Well, I mean, it doesn't make it perfect, I can assure you. And we still have plenty of problems. But it's easier and it's a better way of managing the universe of potential equities that we can own.
Okay. What about the long-term demand in silver when it comes to the energy transition? What do you see going forward here?
Well, I see an entirely unsustainable situation. And indeed, obviously, you will know from our previous conversation, I've been talking about this for a long time. It's very obvious. It's becoming more obvious to other people now. I now see this discussed more widely. The structural problem of mine supply of silver versus the demand for it. You know, solar is the biggest variable because not only has solar become a lot more popular in the last 2 to 3 years for various reasons, but interestingly, the manufacturing process for solar panels has also done a 180-degree turn. And what I mean is every year, less silver was used in a solar panel. It's called thrifting due to technological improvements, a bit like with chips. You saw less silver used per panel. Now, more panels, but less silver used per panel. Mm-hmm. And now we're in a situation where the most popular new kind of panel, and indeed it's dominating the view probably for at least 2 years, and I would imagine beyond, is for a kind of panel which uses substantially more silver rather than less. Due to the efficiency of using more silver, the more you get a better output, a better energy output using more silver. So with that, I see a very difficult situation for the market to clear. You know, if India are importing 20% of all mine supply in 3 months, you know, this can't work really for long. But that also needs to be brought up that, you know, the green transition involves silver in lots of ways, but it's not the most dominating component of the silver market. That is investment. Now, there is no investment demand for silver at the moment, ex a little bit in China. But when people turn around and go, okay, silver's moving, it's got, let's say it gets through $30 an ounce, it's very obvious that there is a big gap on the chart between $30 and $50. And generally people jump on silver when it goes through $30. That will bring a wave of investment demand in that simply can't be satisfied in the current market. So I think it's very interesting what's happening in silver at the moment. It's all been quite obvious for a long period of time to those people paying attention. But I think the key thing is just watch to see whether this narrative gets beyond us discussing it. You know, do you see this? Because that's what will drag people in, is the story getting out.
So silver reached its all-time high. It was like in 2011 maybe, or 12 or so. It was like almost $50 per ounce, no?
So it hit 50 or there, or maybe it was just underneath in 2011. Now, if you adjust that for the CPI, so you adjust 2011 for inflation, that's probably around, I don't know, it's $80, $85. So if you adjust the high from 2011, it's probably $80, $85. So we're a long way below that level. But of course, silver also hit $50 an ounce in 1980. Now, if you adjust $50 an ounce for the CPI since 1980, you can work out for yourself that that's going to be quite a long way from where we are now.
Yeah.
So do you think silver is too cheap?
Well, the reason it's not is because it got demonetized after World War II, and the banking system, in conjunction with the central banks, turned gold and silver, but silver is what we're discussing here, into foreign exchange in the early 1980s. Now, if that hadn't happened, silver would be miles higher than it is now. So this is the point I was making to you earlier. Silver, like gold, the physical is a tiny amount compared to the paper that is traded. That is not true in nickel, copper, oil, anything else. It's only in gold and silver where you have this massive paper market that surrounds the real one, the physical. So yes, I mean, that is, I agree with the question. It is extremely cheap relative to its utility and its need in the modern economy. And indeed, the US Geological Survey said that silver will be the first metal to be exhausted from the Earth's crust. And that's because it's being mined at an uneconomic price.
So thank you very much for your time, Ned.
Not at all. It's a pleasure, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you.